TED Talks are recorded live at the TED Conference and produced with WNYC New York Public Radio. This episode features the inventor of the Segway, Dean Kamen. TED Talks are made possible through the support of BMW. Here's Dean Kamen.
Probably 10 years ago, it seemed to me that if the iBot was going to work, it probably wouldn't have available enough energy in ordinary batteries to give it the kind of capability that humans enjoy, because back then the best batteries in the world had 10 watt-hours per kilogram of energy density, and that was lead acid, and then you go to nickel cadmium at 20 watt-hours, and nickel metal hydride at 40 watt-hours, and lithium ion at 60 watt-hours. But batteries are pretty bad at storing energy, and if you look at the energy in a kilogram of propane, it's 8,750 watt-hours. And human beings, which are, again, powered by more releasing chemical energy, you know, that adenosine triphosphate stuff, we're chocolate chip cookie powered, and chocolate chip cookies got about equivalent energy to a couple of hundred pounds of batteries. So I decided that we would try to find a way to run our iBots effectively on chocolate chip cookies, and it would be a much better system for lots of reasons. I wanted to burn fuel coming out of, for instance, propane, natural gas, so these days it's more popular to talk about hydrogen. I wasn't going to put Grandma on a iBot, this beautiful machine that could walk her up to the opera and then have her start the weed whacker to charge her batteries. So we decided that we would build a little quiet Stirling engine and make it a piece of the system. As usual, I was overly enthusiastic, and a couple of years into the project, it wasn't going to happen that way. So we put the Stirling engine project, as in the battery charger for the iBot, to the side, continued the iBot, but I couldn't give up on the little engine. The goal was to make a 20-pound engine that would trickle-charge these batteries and take the place of one of the 20-pound batteries. A few extra years of development went into it, and we got pretty excited because, although it took a lot more time, we finally had an engine, you can see them running downstairs, that made about 10 times as much energy as we thought. It was also 100 pounds, and it wasn't going to get into a iBot. But I just kept thinking about how neat it was that we could make an engine that would have an extraordinarily long life. It would burn any local source of fuel, literally. And we burned hydrogen, propane, natural gas, diesel fuel, jet A, kerosene, olive oil, it doesn't matter, and make electricity. And so I started thinking about other places to use it, and then the data, which might otherwise seem depressing, started to excite me more, because 2 billion people on this planet have never used electricity. Another 2 billion have it very intermittently, and they can't depend on it. That's two-thirds of the human population. The National Academy of Engineering in the year 2000 published a report that talked about the most important technologies to create an environment where people can get out of poverty, and number one and number two were sanitation, clean water, and distributed electricity, which have happened in 100 years to the rich countries of the world and not to the others. So I decided I would continue to work on this little engine and figure out, since it could run essentially autonomously, it ought to have a 5-year life. It could make small amounts of energy that could be delivered locally to make distributed power sources for the undeveloped world. I started talking to people like the World Health Organization, the United Nations, and all sorts of people to try to get data, and every expert I went to, and I think the experts are the people that can tell you about all the mega programs that cost $20 billion a year that categorically have never worked, don't work, and will not work. But they all run these giant programs, and they're all experts. So I continue to work on the engine and try to think about how to make it attractive and exciting to deploy it to people that essentially don't have the economy and the money, and kept thinking again about the water side of it. And I don't want to go teach thermodynamics here. And I know yesterday I heard that even scientific methods may not be politically correct anymore. And I don't know. You know, to me, science is subtle and sometimes deep. But nature really isn't cruel, and I always go back, and I trust, you know, GMM over R squared, you know, that's not just a good idea, gravity's the law, and it works, and it always works, and the second law of thermodynamics I really loved, and so I started thinking about how you could make water also of the same scale that would be equivalent to the right amount you'd need if you were making electricity in a small town or a village or a house, and here's some numbers for you. It takes about 25,000 watts, to continuously distill 10 gallons an hour of water, which would be 250 gallons a day, which would be plenty for a small house or a small village, 100 people. And the amount of electricity we make with this little box would equally give, I mean, not jacuzzis, but it would give plenty of electricity to give light and the internet and communications to a similar number of people that would use that amount of water. Well, 25 kilowatts is only 50 times as much as is practical. We couldn't afford to make water that way in this country. But we went back, and on the back of an envelope, you can do the calculation that says, supposing you could distill water, you could boil it at one temperature and compress it so that it will condense, believe it or not, at a lower temperature. Fact that you had to do some work in a rule of PDV, we won't get too excited about it. If you can keep the pressure differential fairly small, you ought to be able to actually boil water and recondense it, recapture the energy, the heat, and since you did it at a higher temperature, it'll flow back to the incoming water with counterflow heat exchangers. And to make a long story short, if you happen to have enough electronics around when you were boiling the water, instead of using 25 kilowatts, if you could have a little electricity to keep track very accurately of temperatures, to keep track very accurately of pressures, and to use some of the electricity to run. We then had to invent a little liquid ring pump so that there'd be no mechanical seals and moving parts. What does the second law tell you is the maximum or the minimum energy it would take to boil and recondense and purify, virtually distill, 10 gallons an hour, and it looks like it's a little over 200 watts, not 25 kilowatts. And that's with a delta T of about 1 degree absolute and a delta P of about 1 psi. We built a system, used the electricity coming out of the little engine because the little engine's 20% efficient, so it's making a few hundred watts, but it was giving us a few hundred watts of heat free. That's the waste from the engine. The first one we built took 1,100 watts, not 25 kilowatts. The second one, 800. And the one you'll see downstairs takes about 500 watts, all of which is the waste heat. It's free from making the electricity. There's a bowl down there that we dumped in piles of salt and baking soda, mud, watercolor. And it's continuously running. And this is what comes out of it. And they brought it up for me. You can't taste the salt, the vinegar, or anything else. It's remarkably ordinary. And while lots of people, I think, here think about whether glasses are half full or half empty, 4 out of the 6 billion people on this planet think about, if I drink this, will I die? Because 5 million people a year die from lack of water. To those of you that do arithmetic, that's 13,700 a day, that's 570 an hour, 80% are kids. In Africa, 86% of the people have never used electricity. It's 92% if you take people that are rural. If you put a machine in their village, perhaps, it's not a big centralized system. It doesn't require the 15 years of development. What if you put a system like this and you gave it to an entrepreneur, even if they cost $1,000 to build, the 700 million people, if it took care of 100 people, you'd need 7 million machines. If you took 7 million machines at $1,000 a machine, that's $7 billion. That's one-third of what we're going to pay this year to the 100,000 people that we put at our airports to take the nail clippers away from our grandparents so that we're safer when we fly on the airplanes. But the reason we have to pay them is we're neurotic. The reason we have to do that is because we think they're out to get us. And half of us, I listen to people talk, I'm not a sociologist, but half of us, I think, deep down think they hate us for what we did wrong to them. And half of us I think they hate us for what we did right. We have all the wealth. But either way, they're going to hate us unless we figure out how to use technology to help people. And water and electricity and communications are the most basic things that people need, and two-thirds of the world don't have them. And in the next 20 or 30 or 50 years, they'll never get them through a power grid or centralized water, not in Africa, not in Bangladesh, not in India. And they're not going to get them if they're mega programs that don't work. We've had 50 years of trying to do that. There's got to be a market-based way to give something to somebody that some entrepreneur can use to charge a penny a gallon or a penny a kilowatt hour. The technology's available to do it, I think. We're working at it, but I'm one tiny little company. I'm not the United Nations. I'm not the U.S. government. I don't know how to deploy it. On March 14th, I just found out also this morning I'm going to Niger, where I'll be meeting with six heads of state of six of the countries that joined NEPAD. I'm bringing three working machines, the ones you'll see downstairs. We're going to show them these things. They're going to sit there and make water in real time out in the field, burning any fuel they give us. They're going to make electricity. They each have, since they make electricity, they have the electronics that controls them has a web server in it. So that anywhere in the world, Geneva, if you want to be at the World Health Organization, or here, you can monitor how the machines are doing. You know where they are, how much water they made this week. So the issue of graft and corruption. Every time I take this to some big organization, the experts always can tell you why nothing works. And they can demonstrate it with their 50-year record, so they must be right. But part of me says, so now we'll give them water and we'll make electricity and we'll use local fuel, and you'll make with 700,000 of these 700 local entrepreneurs. And if you put the communications in there so that they can be self-monitoring, you can do diagnostics on it, then the issue, well, but it's very sophisticated electronics, very sophisticated technology. That's right, it is. And that's why we have a high standard of living. So either we believe we do really make productivity tools, or we ought to give up on our own bravado. But if this really is a productivity tool, what the world desperately needs is more people to be productive. Going around the world and giving them anvils and hammers and teaching them how to make horseshoes, I understand why that's failed for 50 years. As much of an invention as there might be in liquid ring pumps, counterflow heat exchangers, vapor compression distillers, Stirling engines that really work, we need a new invention, which is a way to build business and economic models that can bring people from where they are now to a modern world without having to take the few hundred year trip that we took, because that impedance mismatch is too large to do it any other way, which is why I like simple, small systems that you can put a few in a village somewhere. If it works, you scale it up. People will make money with it. You scale it up. It seems that we ought to do that. I could tell you a lot more about it because I don't sleep a lot thinking about a lot of things that we ought to do. I would tell you that I know TED is supposed to be technology, entertainment, and design. This morning I was listening, yesterday listening. You said you want a new TED. I think technology alone is, at least to me in some cases, it's almost a hobby. I mean, the technology of what's in here, the Stirling engine was patented in 1816. Technology doesn't help people. The application of it to make tools, I mean, because you can make weapons out of it too, but the T could be tools. Technology empowers them. Maybe instead of entertainment, how about enlightenment? And I think, you know, it's entertaining to be enlightened. Kids play it first, they're enlightened. And design is one piece of the process. And we've been at it for a while. Design is okay, it just doesn't, maybe the D ought to be to deliver, to be determined, to make a difference. I gotta believe that the real goal ought to be to have confidence that everybody has the same goals, and we don't need to live that way. By the way, the first bioterrorism happened when, in the ancient wars, people used to take bodies of people that had leprosy and catapult them into the villages behind the walls. I mean, terrorism is probably the oldest, not the newest, form of war. They had poison gas in World War I, too. There was a time when most of the world was civilized enough that even when they went to war, so many people had so much to lose, they wouldn't tolerate it. If we keep two-thirds of the world poor, you can't beat them with the internet.
That was Dean Kamen, recorded at the TED Conference in Monterey, California, February 2002. TED Talks are produced by WNYC New York Public Radio for TED and made possible in part through the support of BMW. For more information on TED, visit TED.com.